this is one of my favorite resources for looking at this period. And one of the reasons is it's kind of a funny book to go to because it's not in the typical kind of circles of things I read. But the older I've gotten, and the more I've worked with students over the years, and, you know, I've been doing student ministry for over a decade now. That's kind of insane. And then have older teenagers at this point. They've kind of crossed that midpoint line in the teenager years, and they're getting closer to the end. I'm appreciating more the wisdom in a kind of a mainstream evangelical book like this. These are well thought out people. They're not hostile in any way to the Reformed faith. But whenever you take what we know about ecclesiology, what we know about soteriology, and then you work with a book like this, I think it's a very helpful resource. And so if you ever want to look at that, go back to it. But Dennis Rainey, one of the great things he does when he starts out the book, he has this description of parenting. And he says, essentially, you have three zones. Zone one, the first zone, is the innocence zone. And that's basically, you know, from the time they're an infant until they're about 12 years old, this is a time where children are fairly simple and straightforward with how you deal with them. Doesn't mean there's not difficult kids and stubborn kids and there's not lots of work and parenting. But this is the innocence zone. And kind of a subset of the innocence zone is ages 9 to 12, also known as the tween period. And what characterizes the tween period, he calls it the golden years. And so if you have a child that's there, or if you've been through that recently, you know, this is probably the sweetest spot you will ever hit as a parent. Because you get to that tween period, and your children have learned to bathe by themselves. They brush their teeth. They can fix a plate of food when they need to. They can even help set the kitchen, or set the table for dinner and clean the kitchen afterwards. They can sometimes sort and do laundry. There's all sorts of nifty tricks that these puppies have learned that are kind of fun and enjoyable. Added to that, they're very simple. They don't have a lot of demands. They still have admiration and respect for you as a parent. And you're thinking, we did an amazing job. We're such great parents. And look at the fruit of all of our labors. So it's a happy place to be. But one of the problems is that Randy gives this description. It's actually a true story, but of this these two children and a man who were on a trip to Niagara Falls, and they were actually upstream above the falls, and this man had offered to take these two children out in the boat. And so they'd gone out there, and one of the children is telling the story looking back on it, but he remembers looking out, and they're motoring up and down the river, and you see off of the horizon where, you know, the kind of the trees disappear, and you can't tell exactly what's out there, but there's sort of a mist that's rising. And he's looking at that downstream. Does anybody know what that is? That would be the falls. That's right. The mist is from all the churning water beneath it. And so he talks about having, you know, drifted towards this. They lost a propeller blade and it caused a tragic thing, but the children survived. But this, he said, what a great illustration of coming into the teenage years. It's so calm in that period right there before you get there in the tween periods. But then you get to the teen period and you realize you have gone over the falls. And there's no turning back. The propeller is gone. There's no way to stop it. You go over the falls. This is not a bad thing. This is a good thing. And that's why the goal of this class is to show you, to walk you through this period, what kind of changes take place, and to show you why these are good things, but how you make these good things for your family. If you've got a Bible, go ahead and turn to Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians 6 is one of the very well-known family texts in the Bible. And if you come down to it, you realize that there's really only a handful of really direct family texts in the Bible. There's lots of wisdom out there. You've got a book of Proverbs, which is very useful in parenting. But there's actually, you know, all taken together, there's not just an incredible amount of pedagogical, teaching-oriented texts. Now, this is one of those. It's very simple. Ephesians 6, 1 and 2. This is from the ESV. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may live long in the land. Okay, now stop right there. think how simple that command is. Okay, there's weight added to it by Paul. He gives the importance, the significance of this. Why, children, would you want to obey your parents so that you can live long, that may go well with you? But then look at verse 4. Fathers, or parents, would be fair there. Do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Okay, now think about that command. Is that a simple command? What's complicated about that? Well, first off, how do you not provoke a child to anger? You know, Paul doesn't go into great detail there, right? He just says, don't do it. He assumes that you have some kind of knowledge. But this means we've got to fall back on all of the scriptures as we're trying to understand how do we not provoke a child to anger, to provoke a child to wrath. And then he says to bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And that means that you have just this wealth of things that need to be applied from throughout the scripture of what it means to be nurtured in the Lord. It's not just a handful of family texts in the Bible, but it's the whole Bible that has to come to bear. The wisdom of all of it, the promises of all of it, the commands of all of it that is going into teaching a child. So, rightfully understood, parents, you have an incredibly difficult job. It's not simple. It's complicated. It's comprehensive. And so there's much for you to understand. If you go on in this passage, there's the well-known passage about bondservants and masters in verses 5 through 9. And then you get to verse 10 and 10 through 20. And that is the very well-known passage about putting on the full armor of God. And I think it's not coincidental. I think Paul is moving from point to point, but at least it's helpful for us in the context of thinking about parenting and to think about employment, to also thinking about the fact that we have to put on the full armor of God. And since Pastor Robbins not that long ago was in this text and explained it very well, just think back to what you know about this text. That we're to be strong in the Lord in the strength of His might, to put on the whole armor of God, and then to stand, and all the active ways in which we do that before the Lord and for the Lord to pursue His ends. So parenting takes work, it takes full armor, and it's a comprehensive work that we have to do. So here's the problem. For most parents, when they come to the teen years, it's like that waterfall where they're upstream in the river. They see the river flowing that way. It's calm, but they don't really know what's on the other side, right? And even though every adult person has gone through that period, there's something in us that has blotted out much of our experience in that time. We don't understand it very well. Even though we experienced it, our memories of it are not the same as it is to actively be in it. And so what that results in is I'm going to give you several things that happen. One is that you have what I would call as unprepared parents. This is kind of pictured by the fact that when Junior comes down the stairs and he's wearing the pants that you bought 3 months ago, and they're midway between his knee and his ankle, and you're going, what happened? What's going on here? Wait, did someone wash those in hot water? You're not supposed to do that with new pants. And you realize, no, it's not the washing machine that's the problem. It's the child has grown. And he's grown dramatically in that period. Somehow, as parents, we're always shocked that our children grow. We shouldn't be, because we know that for all over the planet, everything grows. We know that we grew. We know we should expect them to grow. But still, we're surprised by the changes that take place. We shouldn't be surprised. Unpreparedness is an unbiblical quality. We find that in Ephesians 6:13-15. A second response to the teen years and the complexities and the difficulties of the teen years is passive or permissive parenting. And that's where parents respond by just saying, I don't understand them. I will never understand teenagers. I don't know why I should even try. And they literally throw up their hands, they walk away, and they say, you know what, you handle yourself, I'll make sure that you're fed, you have money for clothes, but you're on your own, kid. People do that. They let their children do that. That is also an unbiblical response. We are called to wrestle, as Paul says in Ephesians 6:10-12. A third response is to see what's coming, to see what probably has come for other people, and to respond with fear. And so to look at it and say, oh, we cannot let that happen to our precious baby. We've got to build walls that are high enough. We have to protect their eyes enough. We have to do all these things to keep them from those evil influences so that none of those bad things will happen to them. And the problem with that one is a theological problem, because the thing that the children are going through is, one, it's part of God's design for them, and two, they're wrestling with a sin nature that is within them. It's not outside of them. And so, yes, there are evil influences, there are temptations, there are bad friends that can corrupt their morals. But the root of the problem is always going to be inside of them. That's the fundamental problem that has to be dealt with as a parent. So the final response to that, the fourth option to it, is to parent wisely, to wisely engage with your children in this period. So this is an effort to help you with that. So what should you expect for teenagers? Well, this is I want to help you think and anticipate what's coming. Let me comprehensively kind of say this at the beginning. Our children, for the most part, from that infant, through maybe 12 years old, our children tend to grow in sort of a linear fashion. Okay, they just kind of get bigger and they get smarter and more responsible as time goes on. Those of you with children, have you noticed this? And so, they have the awkward phase where, they get these teeth that are too big for their head and they look kind of, weird, and they're kind of gangly in periods in there. That happens. But for the most part, there's an even trajectory that you can see and appreciate. But what happens when they get to the teenage years is they grow in different directions. Okay, so it's no longer just a sort of a linear fashion of growth, but they start growing in different ways in different directions. And of course, this happens physically. You can see this in females, the way that God changes their bodies. And if you're a father, you're looking, you're going, oh, what is going on here? Make it stop. But you don't want it to stop, but it just means that you have to deal with that reality. But also, not only that, We'll deal with this in a few moments, but they're changing in how they think. And you have to be equipped to deal with this as well. So here's what we're going to do about it. First, today in this class, we're going to talk about anticipating those changes and posturing yourself for those. The next one, we're going to get more specific and we're going to deal with relationships. How you deal with friends and special friends and scary temptations that all sort of go together. That you want to know about and be prepared for in the teenage years. The third class, we're going to talk about technology, because that's a major component now in the present day, to think about how is technology going to factor in to the life of my teen and think through strategies for that. And in the fourth one, we're going to go back to something I keep going back to, is vocation. How you project where your children might go and you help them get to the place that God is calling them to in this life. So today, let's start with anticipation. The number one thing, you see this on your list. I started to leave these as all blanks, but I thought, no, I don't want people to get distracted and forget or get lost. So the first thing that you have to realize is that there are hormonal changes. Okay, you know about this. You've had classes and health classes on puberty. You know all the things that go along with that. But as a Christian parent, what you want to understand is Psalm 134, when David says, I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. Is that we have to appreciate that that's not just about how David was made in the womb, or how any of us are made in the womb, but it's how God made us in the womb, fearfully and wonderfully, for all those things that are in that seed that are going to grow into that massive thing, that oak tree at the end of it. Is it how God has intended for these changes to take place? And I think maybe moms, I think it's probably an equal struggle. Moms wrestle with the fact that their boys get stinky. He was cute and sweet and his face was so smooth and soft. But then one day there's these weird little things that grow out of his chin. And he smells funny in a way that he's not like your precious baby anymore. And you kind of want to push him away. That those changes are going to take place. Fathers, again, with your daughters, all of a sudden they become incredibly complex and you don't understand this was so simple and now it's complicated. It's difficult. I don't understand her the same way that I used to. You want to understand all of that was God's design in the womb, that they would grow through these things. You want to embrace that. Sort of the historical term that even Paul uses this. In 2 Timothy, when he talks about flee youthful passions, the word passions is not actually in that. It's just flee youthfulness, because there's something bound up in that period of life that you can tell from the context is pointing towards the way young people act in bad ways frequently. But he's acknowledging this is the quality of that period. It's difficult. And there are things that are moving them that they don't even understand themselves. The first thing is to understand those hormonal changes are by design and they're moving them in this direction. The second thing is the physical changes. Those hormones result in physical changes in the body. I was hoping Billy Whitbeck was in here today, but you know, I look at Billy Whitbeck and I think he was not that size when he was in seventh grade, right? He's a big man. And that's because God gave him hormones that grew him up into the large person that he is today. When they grow in this period, it's not going to be even. Like I said, it's not linear anymore. There are kind of fits and starts along the way. There's a lack of correspondence between the growth and the coordination that goes along with it. And they're trying to understand that for themselves. And so sometimes, you know, you may be walking by the bathroom and the door is open and your son is in there with his shirt off in front of the mirror and he's doing this number and he's looking and he's trying to figure out what's going on here. Do I look like, you know, I have muscles or not? He's trying to figure himself out. And you know, you could say, oh, he's really, you know, he's proud. He's looking at himself in the mirror. That may be going on. That could be part of it. But he's also just trying to understand, am I as big as other guys? How do I fit in? Am I, you know, can I do this? Will I be competitive? How do I relate? That's part of those things that are now confusing for them that they didn't have to ask before. The third thing is emotional changes. For girls, there's a lot of random and unexplained crying. And it stays with them the rest of their life. For boys, there's a lot of anger. For boys, there's a lot of anger and aggression and surliness. Moodiness, quietness, and you can actually have crossover on both of those. You can have boys that cry unexplainably. You can have girls that get surly and dark. There's just emotions that change dramatically, and you won't understand why, and they won't understand either, but it will happen. A fourth thing that changes are what we call intellectual changes. They're getting smarter, which is what we all want. At the same time, they're learning from teachers that they haven't had before. They've been exposed to a bigger world, and they begin to outgrow your ability to teach them. And so if you've been homeschooling, and if you've homeschooled for a long time, you know there's a point where all of a sudden you realize, I can't teach this subject. Because most of us, we tend to, you know, we may be experts in one subject or another, but at some point, they're having to learn about things that you're not equipped for. So the quadratic formula, I know I knew that at one time, but I can't do that now. Or maybe it's literature. Yeah, I wrote papers, but I hate English grammar and don't want to have anything to do with it. Somebody teach my child. And so there's other teachers come into their lives, and you hire out, or you get other people that are equipped to do that. Or they become autodidacts. They're self-taught. But in being self-taught, the place where you want them to grow, they're going to be learning from other people. And that means new ideas that will come into their lives that you may not agree with and that you'll have to deal with. So they're intellectual changes. There are also environmental changes. And principally among those would be the things that they're exposed to that you want them to be exposed to, but that are going to make it more difficult. So maybe they begin a job for the first time. That means a whole world of responsibilities and relationships that they haven't encountered before. Maybe it's also the relational changes. Along with the growth that's taking place in them is also the growth in all of these sweet children that they've been growing up with. And so it used to be feel like a safe place for them to play with this person down the street or with these kids in the elementary Sunday school. But then all of a sudden you look and you realize, wow, that is not the same kid that I've known for the past 10 years. Even though it is, but they look dramatically different and they have dramatically different interests. So relational changes are a part of it. I think one of the ways I wanted to describe that was you may have boys noticing girls for the first time, and so that will make, you know, the youth room scary. But then you also have girls noticing if boys notice them, which happens about 2 years before the girls begin or before the guys begin to notice the girls. And so that makes that complicated as well. In any case, you're never ready for it, but it does happen. Also, after relational changes or risk changes, when our children were young, we were worried about streets and electrical outlets. When they were preteens, we were thinking more about breaking their arms. And now, when they get into the teenage years, you realize that their choices are dramatic and they shape the rest of their life. And you can put your finger in a socket and you could probably get away with it a couple of times. You can break an arm, you cast it, and you recover. But the decisions that are being made in the teenage years, when a person gets into a car, or they get into a car with a certain person, you realize this is a life-changing, life-altering decision every time that takes place. And then finally, something that we hardly ever acknowledge are the cost changes. Food, clothing, sports, fashion sensibilities, appetites, if you have a boy, are amazing. And then just if you don't know this is coming, your insurance will literally triple when you put a boy behind the wheel. Okay, your car insurance. So some of you start saving now. Forget the wedding that you were saving for your daughter. Just save for car insurance because it's amazing. So all of these things, these are facts. I didn't invent these. This is not something you get to debate and say, well, Scotty, I disagree with you. Okay, go ahead. You can disagree, but it's coming anyway, whether you want to admit it or not. So what are you going to do about it? Well, here's how you posture yourself for this time. The first thing that you need to do is to accept and celebrate. And I realize I'm lacking some agreement there grammatically. It should be accept and celebrate, or acceptance and celebration. I know, it happens. Yes, the boys will get sneaky. The girls are going to grow in ways that you don't want them to. The emotions are going to be turbulent, disproportional, irrational. All of those things can take place in that period. But you have to embrace these things, as these are according to God's design and they serve a useful purpose because it's moving them towards adulthood. If you go back to the scriptures, Job talks about mountain goats. They become strong. They grow up. In the open, they go out and they do not return. And that's kind of a picture of what happens in some degree with our children, is that those things happen and you recognize the nature that's good. And it's also good to a certain degree with our children. In 1 Samuel, we see that Samuel in 2:26 is that he continued to grow both in stature and in favor with the Lord and also with man. The same thing is said of Jesus, Luke 2:52. Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. So all of those things, you see, this is God's design, and you don't do well to fight it. You do well to embrace it, and even to go beyond that, to celebrate it. Okay, so what do I mean by celebrating it? So here's the thing, and this is where you have to go against human nature, your natural response. Mom, that day that you go to hug your son, and he smells bad, that's normally a cause for wrinkling your nose, pulling away and saying, what happened to my baby? Instead, what you want to do is pull them all the closer and kind of lean and go, oh, you stink. That means you're becoming a man. Hallelujah. The Lord has made you into a man. You embrace him and squeeze him and hug him. And say, you know what? We've got to go buy deodorant because you're a man now. My wife is tearing up as they say that. But it's true. I'm going to tell an embarrassing story about my wife from her childhood. But whenever she came, you know, I know she's flinching. I should have warned her ahead of time, but she's got to stay married to me. Is whenever she came to that period of womanhood, that marks out the transition, that's a hormonal related change, her father took her out to celebrate it. Okay. How is that for embracing? Okay. This is this mysterious area of life that men don't understand and have an incredibly difficult time understanding. I don't understand all that stuff and don't want to. Why do these changes take place? What is that? I don't want to walk in the bathroom and know about this stuff. Her father said, you know what, sweetie, let's go out to dinner. He wanted to talk about it, and he celebrated that with her. And how encouraging is that for them entering into that period to know that you are glad to see them growing up? You're not resistant to it, but you're going to celebrate it whenever they enter into that period of God doing that for them. So celebrate it with them however you can. And there are lots of little things that you can identify that you can celebrate. Getting a driver's license, a first job, whatever it might be, find reasons to celebrate how God is growing them up. Don't let your response always be, oh, I hate that this is happening. I hate that this is costing me money. I hate that you smell this way. Embrace it. Second thing is direction. Is you have to continue to be committed to giving direction to your children. Listen to the disposition that Solomon has. Proverbs 1:8-10, he says, hear, my son, your father's instruction, and forsake not your mother's teaching, for they are a graceful garland for your head, a pendant for your neck. My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. But his disposition towards it is to say, son, I know you're growing up, And I know that you're leaving my ability to be in control of every aspect of your life. But I'm encouraging you still, don't forsake the teaching of your childhood. Don't let go of this. Hold on to this. Make this something that continues to guide you even when you're far away from me. If you're trying to give direction in the teenage years, it's going to look different than it does for the younger children. We just tell them what to do and you expect immediate joyful obedience. Yes, you can still do that, and it's still right for them to obey you immediately and joyfully whenever you command them. But at the same time, you don't want to be doing that as the way that you give directions to your children all the time as teenagers. That does not encourage them in maturity and adulthood. And so what my daughter has painfully learned many times that she will come to me or my wife and ask us a question. Our response to her is not, no, that's stupid, which we're thinking on the inside. Instead, what she hears back from us is a question. I don't know. What do you think? What would be a good time to be home from this event? Well, this is okay. What would you say if I said this? And it's a series of questions that go back and forth between her and us. And eventually, we hope she comes to the point of saying, you know what, probably I ought to be home by such and such time. And you go, you know what, that's a great idea. I'm glad that you've decided to do that. It takes work. It takes energy. It takes time to do that. But resist giving that immediate no that your intelligence and maturity tell you is warranted. And instead engage with them in that conversation to help them come to that point. Sometimes you have to tell them, sweetie, no, that's all wrong. No, you can't do it. That person's a fool and I would never let you get in the car with them. But when you can enter into that conversation, do it and bring them along with you. A third thing to have as part of your posture is sympathy. Teenagers are full of silliness. There's a pediatric neurologist, Frances Jensen. She works at Children's Hospital in Boston. She had teenagers, and she said, wow, I thought it was smart. I don't understand these. I need to do some real research into this. And so this was her job, and so now she made it her full-time job, is to be a pediatric neurologist. And so listen to some of what she has to say. Scientists used to think that human brain development was pretty much complete by age 10. Whereas she puts it, that a teenage brain is just an adult brain with fewer miles on it. Not true. To begin with, she says, a crucial part of the brain, the frontal lobes, are not fully connected. Really. That's because the nerve cells that connect teenagers' frontal lobes with the rest of their brains are sluggish. Teenagers don't have as much of the fatty coating called myelin or white matter that adults have in this area. Did you know that? Right, this is a joke in our house. We constantly talk about frontal lobe development, but that's the actual science behind it. She said, think of it as an insulation on an electrical wire. Nerves need myelin for nerve signals to flow freely. Spotty or thin myelin leads to inefficient communication between one part of the brain and another. It's the part of the brain that says, is this a good idea? What is the consequence of this action? Jensen says, it's not that they don't have a frontal lobe. You might think that. But that they're going to access it more slowly. Recent studies show that neural insulation isn't complete until the mid-20s. Okay, this is why teenagers are horrible drivers and really scary. They don't make connections. Even though they've watched you drive a car for the past 15 and a half years of their lives, even though they've watched these videos, they've been with professional drivers that teach them how to do it, they still make incredibly poor decisions when they're driving. And frequently, you know, just so you know, when you agonize over that first car that you're going to buy for your child and you're looking at this and this and you'll shop for about 6 months trying to figure out, you know, how can I get this deal? Just don't put that much energy into it because it's going to be marred, you know, within the first 6 months one way or another. You want it to be safe. Yes, as safe as it can be. But don't go for glitter. It's not going to stay pristine. But this is one of horrible drivers. It's also a reason that they're so surly and they seem so selfish so much of the time, so self-interested, is because they aren't making connections that we make. They can say, so-and-so hurt my feelings. I can't believe they said this about me. You know, I hate so-and-so, and I, you know, the way she dresses, I just don't understand it. It looks ridiculous. Sweetie, you were just complaining a second ago about somebody said something hurtful, and now you're talking to this other about this other person over here about what you hate about them. Do you see that you're criticizing this one person for the very thing you're doing? I'm not talking about you, Avery. Just relax. They won't realize that. And sometimes as adults, we don't realize that either. But they're really bad at that. They don't make those connections. They have to be forced to make those connections and have those connections be processed for them over and over and over again. So there's the physical aspect of it. The other part that needs to have sympathy is are their sins. And this is interesting. Don't take me the wrong way on this. But we have to have sympathy for their sins. And this is actually biblical. We're not saying sins are okay. But we're sympathetic to the sins that they experience. Listen to Genesis 8:21. It says, "When the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, 'I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will ever again strike down every living creature as I have done.'" So he talks about the sinfulness of youth there. This problem doesn't go away. Job 13:26. Job says, "For you write bitter things against me and make me inherit the iniquities of my youth." He's acknowledging there that this period in his life, Job, this righteous man, brings up, yeah, there was this period of my youth where I did foolish and wicked things, and you're visiting these things on me. And then Proverbs 25:7, David says, "Remember not the sins of my youth or my transgressions. According to the steadfast love, remember me for the sake of your goodness, O Lord." And so it's a fact. When Paul describes it in 2 Timothy 2, he describes it as flee youthfulness or flee youthful passions. He's recognizing there's this tendency to fall into these sins in this period. The sins aren't okay. It's not that they're not sins. It's that they are. But that you have to have sympathy as they go through that period. The same kind of sympathy the Lord had for you. Psalm 103, "The Lord is merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. He will not always chide, nor will he keep his anger forever. He does not deal with us according to our sins, nor repay us according to our iniquities. For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his steadfast love towards those who fear him. As far as the east is from the west, so far does he remove our transgressions from us. And as a father shows compassion to his children, so the Lord shows compassion to those who fear him, for he knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust." Just think of the Lord's compassion. And even as he points to fathers, he says, fathers are compassionate towards their children. They should be. This is expected. Parents should be compassionate towards their children. And at the same time, you recognize their sinfulness and their proclivity to sinful behavior in this period. You also recognize that they're called to something higher and that they can walk with the Lord. Because at the same time, David says, "Remember not the sins of my youth." He also says in Psalm 71:5, he says, "For you, O Lord, are my hope, my trust, O Lord, from my youth." Psalm 71:17, "O God, from my mouth you have taught me, and I still proclaim," or "from my youth you have taught me, and I still proclaim your wondrous deeds." That in this sort of dichotomous period where their minds are all jumbled, they're going to be sinning in messy ways that you're going to have to deal with, that they're going to have to repent of. And there also can be fearing the Lord and calling upon the Lord even in that same time period. And your response to that is to be sympathetic towards them in that. Remember the Lord's sympathy to you. The fourth thing to consider is dignity. And this certainly fits with considering their sinfulness. They need to be treated with dignity. You don't abandon your Calvinism. You don't stop understanding their depravity. But you do recognize that there's going to be a requirement, a need to give them more space and more privacy. And we'll talk more about that in technology because I'm not for absolute privacy in any sense of the word. But you do want to acknowledge that there are going to be things that become embarrassing to them. Especially what you want to remember is that as they get older, if their personhood becomes clearer, their maturity in relationships will come to the forefront, and that where you used to be able to talk about your young children around other people and to other people about your young children, and it wasn't really a big deal, the older they get, the less you ought to be doing with that. You ought to be preserving their dignity and their privacy. Their issues are not for public consumption. Does that make sense? We can talk more about that. So preserve their dignity, and then also encourage their dignity. And so one of the things that you'll be fighting with your teenagers is helping them to understand the implications of what they do. Again, this will also be part of the technology talk. But young girls have this terrible habit of wanting to expose themselves in various ways to as many people as possible. And so the reason they typically do this is they want validation. They want to know that they're okay. And so they'll put a picture up on Instagram of them in their bikini at the beach. And you're saying, you know, as an adult, you're going, why would you do this? Who thought this was a good idea? Why? The rest of the world doesn't need to know about this. They don't need to see this. They want somebody to affirm them is what's going on there. They will also, I've seen girls where they will journal their deepest, inmost parts of their heart and put that into a public space electronically. Woe is me, nobody loves me. Or, I'm in love now and I want all the world to know it. And you as an adult are going, no, this is not for the world to know about. This is for you to process at home, to talk about these things, but this is not for everyone else in the world to hear. Because someday Derek Scott may want to hire you, and he's going to pull up this thing and say, did you know that everyone here knows about this thing that you wrote back when you were in eighth grade and you put for the world to hear? Derek actually does it. He looks at people's Facebook profiles and everything else before they hire you. He will testify to that. So help them preserve their own dignity. This time period is going to be full of dying to self. Most parents think that they had it bad when they had infants. Oh, I never sleep. And then they got toddlers and they go, oh, they're wearing me out. It's just exhausting chasing them around all day. And then they get into those preteen years. Well, I'm driving to soccer practice and I'm driving over here. And this is all this. Okay, that's the easy period. Then you get to the teenage years. And the clock reverses. Instead of being up in the middle of the night or driving all over the place, it becomes what you do late at night with them. When do they want to talk to you? Usually at the very end of the day. Avery, on multiple occasions, has come in and plopped down on her bed, 10:30, 10:45. I should have been asleep 2 hours before that. And there she wants to talk. And mom goes, wake up, sit up. And she's subtle, but she's saying, your daughter wants to talk. It's like, okay, all right, time to get up. You know, if I have to, put on a pot of coffee, but the girl wants to talk, let her talk. Your sons will do this too, although it's usually not bed at the end of the night. It might be when they have a ball in their hand, they want to throw it. It might be when they're out driving a car. But you want to seize opportunities to engage with them. And so it means dying to self in what you'd rather be doing, especially when you get to the teen years. You're getting older and more tired, but that's the time to engage with them. And that's when they most need you. You also, as part of dying to self, is you may have to die to expectations. I know many of parents, especially fathers, who have said things like myself, is any man that comes into my daughter's life is going to have to do this, this, and this. And we say those things, we're very proud about those things, and we're setting the bar very high. And then all of a sudden you get to that stage in life and you realize, boy, I wasn't even anything close to that. I would not have a wife today if I had to meet those standards. And there's probably not a person like that on the planet, and my daughter's probably not good enough for him if he does exist, although you're pretty great, Abe. So you will change some of those expectations you have and say, you know what, I need to let this go. This is not something I need to process that way, but there are other ways to get to finding the young man who's suitable for your daughter, and likewise making your son be who he ought to be. So you may have to die to your expectations. And then, of course, there needs to be agreement. That's between you and your spouse. So a lot of conversations behind closed doors that you work out before you come back together and resolve those. Husbands especially, don't answer too quickly. A lot of times your wife knows way more than you do about what's going on with your kids, and so you want to engage her on those things. And the very last thing that's there, and the last part's brief, is to enjoy them. When God blesses you with a teenager, enjoy them. It is a wonderful time in life. If you are cultivating those relationships and having those conversations, you move out of having to give spankings and into having a relationship that's on a peer level in some relationships. Yes, in some ways. Yes, they still have to obey you. Yes, you're still giving direction. You're still the parent. But you'll be able to talk about things that you've never talked about before. You'll be able to enjoy things together in a way that they could have never enjoyed before when they were younger. And it is a blessing and a privilege that you should be enjoying and embracing and celebrating with them, because God is growing them up. It's what you desire for them. And if all is moving in that right direction, then it will be a pleasure for you to do that. So last thing here, just as we wrap up. This is from back from Dennis Rainey in Parenting Today's Adolescent. He says, if I could have just 30 minutes with any parent and I want to tell them this is what your priorities should be, this is what you should commit yourself to, it's these things. Very simply, prayer. Is the complexities of the teenage years ought to drive you to your knees to pray for your children. You should have been praying for them before, but when you recognize how ill-equipped you are to be everything that they need, then that's when you go to your knees and you say, Lord, make them into what they ought to be. Pray for them desperately. Keep your standards. Your children, in all their confusion, they are looking for some anchors in their life. Hold to certain standards and be steadfast in those. There are some things that are going to change as they get older, but there are some things that should never change. Be involved. Be actively involved and engaged with your children. If you don't know what's going on with them, that is a major problem in your parenting. That has to change. Continue to give training. They're still developing and still growing, and like anybody, they get better with practice. So spend time with them, giving them opportunities to practice doing right things. Talking about how to do right things. Fifthly, give them community. Specifically, give them the community of your family and your church. Do not allow them or yourself to pull away from the church and the people who are in the church. They need those relationships with the older people. They need the continued witness from the pulpit ministry, and they need that peer group that's in the church. Yes, they will grow up and they will grow out, and their relationships will change and get bigger, but make sure they stay grounded in the church. The Lord blesses that. Continue to give direction about character, about relationships, and especially about their mission in life, what they're becoming. And then finally, your priority is perseverance. Paul says in Galatians 6:9, let us not grow weary of doing good, for in due season we will reap if we do not give up. That belongs to every parent. This period is tough. It's difficult. It's joyful, but it absolutely requires you to persevere in it. All right, let me pray. And then after I pray, I want to give you just a direction for next week. Father, thank you for the blessing of teenagers and the growth that you give them. We pray desperately for your Spirit to work in the lives of our children, that they would be converted soundly, that they would love righteousness, that they would walk according to your paths, that they would seek your glory and your kingdom. Do these things and make us what we ought to be in order to shepherd them in this. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen. All right, next week we're going to be talking about preparing for special friends and relationships. We may need to change venues, so we'll talk about that. We may be in the youth room, but the plan will be, is after we've met, is that for whoever wants to, we will go into a Q&A lunch. It'll be kind of a bring your own sort of a thing, or we'll get some direction on that. But if we have the right space, we'll go ahead and meet in the youth room, and we'll continue to have this conversation. You can ask questions as we fellowship together over food. All right? You're dismissed.